Miami developers are building in neighborhoods that are on higher ground due to sea level rise. The minority communities that have lived in those neighborhoods for decades are feeling the pressure. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There's a new podcast series created by WNYC in collaboration with WLRN. It looks at how Black Miamians are being forced out because they live in areas that don't flood.
They didn't know the science. They just knew and understood that when flooding happens everywhere else, it don't flood over here.
Also, we'll remain on this topic as we talk with Miami's resilience officer, Jane Gilbert. We'll ask her about how our leaders are dealing with these problems for the future. And we'll look into a new film about life in Cuba, filmed entirely in IMAX. It's a love song to the island. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Here's a harsh reality about life in Miami. The sea levels are rising, and that's going to force us to eventually move away from the shore to higher ground. That higher ground is in places like Liberty City and Little Haiti because of Miami's limestone ridge. Development is eyeing those regions, and in some cases moving in with construction of expensive condos. People who've lived in Little Haiti are now being priced out. The phenomenon has generated a new term, getting a lot of buzz. It's called climate gentrification. WNYC's podcast, The Stakes, is doing a three-part series called There Goes the Neighborhood Miami. The first part was released today, and the other parts will come out tomorrow and Thursday. You'll be able to hear excerpts of the podcast during Morning Edition and All Things Considered all this week, and you can listen to the full versions of the podcast each day at WLRN.org. Now, we spoke with WLRN's Nadege Green about her reporting and how she was brought in to tell this story for a national audience. So take us back to the history of Little Haiti. One of the people that you talked to for that history was Miami Herald photographer Carl Joost.
Yeah, so Little Haiti was really created, like what we know as Little Haiti, in the 1970s when you saw the first large waves of Haitian migrants coming from Haiti to Miami, and they were fleeing the brutal and violent dictatorships of François Duvalier, also known as Papa Doc, and then his son took over, Jean-Claude Duvalier, known as Baby Doc. And you just saw a wave of Haitian migrants coming here. They were known as boat people at the time. It is what the media coined it as. You saw just a large wave of Haitians coming here. But I should say, before Little Haiti became Little Haiti, it was known as, or parts of it was, a historic African-American community called Lemon City. But through the 70s and the 80s, it really became Little Haiti. And Carl was telling me, Carl was part of this series because his dad, Vita Gis, actually has a mural. There's a mural of his dad in Little Haiti because he is the man that people points to as the one who really coined the term Little Haiti. And it happened during an interview with a reporter from the Miami Herald.
And he said, well, if the Cubans can have a little Havana, the Haitians can have a little Port-au-Prince. And the reporter said, that's kind of long. He said, yeah, I guess you're right. I guess they could have a little Haiti. And the Herald reporter, I guess, quoted him. And ever since afterwards, that area was known as Haiti.
I wanted to know if there are boundaries. If somebody from out of town came in and said, where's Little Haiti? What would you say?
So if you ask someone from Miami from like the 90s and before, they'll likely tell you that the boundaries of Little Haiti go as far south as like the 40s, late 30s, all the way up to 82nd Street. But today, over time, the boundaries of what was considered Little Haiti has shrunk. So I think it's fair to say now what people consider Little Haiti is from about 54th Street to just a little north of 62nd Street. You know, north of 62nd Street used to also be considered Little Haiti, all the way up to 82nd Street before you get to the village of El Portal. People used to call that Northern Little Haiti. But as many of those Haitian-owned businesses that were in that northern corridor either disappeared or were asked to leave, or they didn't have their leases renewed, you're now seeing, you don't see many Haitian businesses there anymore. So as a result, that area is no longer really considered, you know, Little Haiti as it used to be.
Let's talk about this big project, controversial project, the Magic City Development Project. Why was it so controversial?
I mean, ultimately why you saw a lot of pushback on Magic City in the community was it was a question of gentrification. There were questions about displacement. There were questions about who is this for? And within the context of this project, we don't really delve into like the back and forth on, you know, Magic City as far as, you know, should it be here? Should it not be here? But really what the benefit is of Little Haiti, not just to Magic City to Little Haiti, but Little Haiti to Magic City, because at a lot of the community meetings, you know, Magic City talked about, Magic City developers had many town halls in the community, as they should have, to talk about the project. And you heard like this project is going to bring, you know, commerce into the community. It's an added benefit to the community. But one of the things that the developers didn't really talk about at any of the public facing meetings that I went to or saw was that Little Haiti is also looked at in, within the context of this project as an added benefit to it because Little Haiti doesn't flood. So in the documents that Magic City gave to the city of Miami for their application for what's called a special area plan, which is when you have 9 contiguous acres, you're able to build denser and differently outside of the zoning codes. Their special area plan application noted that because Little Haiti sits on this ridge, that their project will be resilient because it'll be resilient from sea level rise, that it will be less prone to flooding. So it's a direct connection between high elevation and development in a way that we really haven't seen yet in Miami. That's just black and white, that it says it right there.
What do they want to build there? What's the promise?
Well, Magic City is not promise. This is what they say that they're going to build. They're going to build, you know, high rises, high-end luxury housing, condos. There's going to be hotels there, co-working spaces. And so it's going to be like a little mini city within the community, not probably unlike what you see in Midtown.
And there are people who support it. There are obviously a lot of people who do not like this idea.
Absolutely. Magic City has supporters even within the Haitian community, right? Like there are some folks within the Haitian community who say, you know what, that this is going to help the community. You know, it'll bring people in. And the idea is to fold in the Haitian community within that. But again, but within the context of this project, it looks at specifically the connection between development, elevation, and the pressures within a community. And what we're seeing is that, you know, these are neighborhoods that would be under pressure anyways because of their proximity to downtown Miami. Little Haiti is just a few minutes away from Midtown. It's just a few minutes away from downtown Miami. Same for Liberty City, right? So you have what you'll call, like, let's call it regular gentrification, right? Like that is happening, that these neighborhoods are under pressure and people are still building on the coast. They're still building in low-lying areas. But this is also looking at knowing that elevation is a key issue here, that sea level rise is real, and this is a community that takes that seriously. How does that connect with what we're seeing, like the pressures in the community? How do those things intersect? Does climate accelerate gentrification? Does it make it go faster? And that is the theory that we explore over 3 episodes.
Can we give a definition what gentrification is?
Gentrification typically is when you have new investment come into a community that typically is lower income, where, you know, I will say that these communities have always been valued by the people who live there. But now you have like a wave of new investment that comes in that threatens to push them out, right? So as you are building these new buildings and new businesses, that is not necessarily for the people who are there. And so it brings in new residents into the community. And as a result, the folks, low-income folks typically, who long call these communities home, get priced out.
Are businesses in this area buying in to what Magic City's going to do?
Again, certainly I've talked to business owners and folks who are like, I spoke to one woman who, Mimi Sanon Jules, who was priced out of her thrift store in Little Haiti, and she thinks, look, Magic City could be a good thing for the community.
A lot of Haitian people used to have money. They don't invest in the community. And this is the problem we have. If it's yours, nobody can come take it from you. But if it's not yours, they can come here anytime and said, when it's time for you to move, and you move. And the way Magic City going to build, I would like to have a spot there. I can have my juice and vegan food there, but I don't know yet. But I would like to, because I love Little Haiti. Little Haiti, it's me, I'm Haitian. You know, I would like to have a spot in Little Haiti, but I don't see the light.
It's not whether or not, you know, it's good for the community or bad really is not like what we're looking at. It's like, what are the pressures? What is happening? And what will be the effect of that, right? And in this case, if we're starting to see from developers who are pointing to the high elevation, to, you know, city commission studies that say, look, it's going to make sense to build on high elevation. Even if you look at Little Haiti, for example, is predominantly renters. If you look at who buys in Little Haiti, there is a significant amount of speculation that has been happening in Little Haiti since the housing bust, right? You see all these LLCs buying properties in the neighborhood. But if you look at the name of the LLCs that are buying property, they even speak to elevation. There's one LLC that I found that has two properties in Little Haiti, and it's called Premium Elevation LLC. So again, it's taking this idea that has been looked at as, you know, this is anecdotal, you know, maybe this is happening, maybe this is not happening, but we can point to some very specific things that says, look, high elevation land, high ground in the city of Miami is becoming one of the pushes in these neighborhoods. And you're seeing it happen in Little Haiti and in communities like Liberty City, for example. I know people are looking at what's happening in Little Haiti and they're looking and they're like, this could happen here, because Liberty City, just west of Little Haiti, also sits on high elevation.
I'm speaking with WLRN reporter Nadege Green. She reported on a new series produced in partnership with WNYC's podcast, The Stakes. The three-part series called There Goes the Neighborhood, Miami. It'll be released today, tomorrow, and Thursday. You can hear excerpts from the podcast during Morning Edition and All Things Considered on WLRN. And you can visit WLRN.org to find more and to listen to the full episodes. Look for The Stakes on WLRN Presents or wherever you listen to podcasts. Can a community keep its identity if you have so much new development coming in and then you have the gentrification? I mean,
a community's identity is rooted in its people. If the people who made the community is no longer there, then, I mean, I guess it's a community in name only, but I don't know if that identity will stick.
Are people afraid that one day Little Haiti will disappear?
I mean, Louis Wozoma is, I call him a senior statesman in Little Haiti. He's a 61-year-old man. And I was with him 7 months ago, or just nearly a year ago, when he got his eviction notice. He lives about a block away from where Magic City is going to build. And his landlord, even though the apartment building he was in was pretty run down, it was fairly cheap. It was one of the few places where you could get an apartment for under $1,000. He was paying $700 a month, and he was sharing that with a roommate, right? So that's fairly affordable for someone who is living on a fixed income, Social Security, and every now and then he's a painter, so he'll sell one of his canvases, but that was just like extra money, right? When he got evicted, he could not find another place in Little Haiti that he could afford. When Louis Wozoma got his eviction notice, he blamed it on this wave of development and investors in and around Little Haiti. Every day, he says, the developers are advancing, and there's not much that can be done. He says, this is a country of power and money, and developers have both. I met up with Louis 7 months after he was evicted from his Little Haiti apartment. He no longer lives in the neighborhood. He couldn't find an apartment he could afford. I went to visit him where he's living now, in North Miami Beach.
So, combien de temps gen la kay sa kounya?
Depuis un septembre mois là.
He's renting a room inside of someone's house.
Little Haiti is belong for Haitian. Now I'm in North Miami Beach. It's not easy for me. So my home is Little Haiti.
That apartment building that he was evicted from is now an empty lot with a for sale sign on it. And so that is what people are concerned about, which is, okay, now that someone like this gets displaced, how does he ever come back? Will he ever be able to come back, right? And I know the city is working on this, that they are, you know, studying what, you know, a affordable housing master plan for the entire city, and they're trying to create policies around this. But for folks like Louis Wozoma, those policies are just simply not coming quick enough.
And you talked about Liberty City. And again, this is an area that sits much higher than the rest of the city. When you talk about sea level, they see what's happening. They're concerned as well. I mean, what kind of conversations do you hear?
Again, people look at Little Haiti and they're like, that's the warning shot, right? Like, look what happened in Little Haiti, that this could happen here too. Again, Liberty City is 10 feet and up above sea level. And, you know, Miami is very different than the rest of the country. And a lot of other parts of the country, predominantly Black communities, are in low-lying areas, you know, by design, by exclusionary zoning and redlining and racist housing policies, places like New Orleans, parts of Texas, you know, parts of North Carolina, even like black communities are in low lying areas and are at risk of flooding. Miami did it in reverse, right? The coastal areas were the places to be. And as a result of that, so predominantly white communities were on the coast or near the coast, again, because of redlining and racist housing policies. It was like whites only on this side. We're going to put the black folks just west of the railroad tracks. The railroad tracks in Miami are a dividing line. Anyone from Miami knows like west of the railroad is where you're going to find black communities. From the railroad, Biscayne Boulevard East is where white communities were. And this was by design. The railroad was built on this limestone ridge that was high elevation because you don't want the railroad to flood. But that dividing line was not just elevation, it was also race. One side was white, one side was black. And as a result, you saw more investment on east of the railroad tracks. Neighborhoods west of the railroad track did not see the same amount of investment, largely because redlining made it such that banks would not even loan in a lot of these communities. And so we also have to look at the historic nature of how these communities came to be. But the result, the end result is that development was like low development in low-lying areas was pushed and was invested in heavily. While these high elevation areas were considered, you know, not the neighborhoods to be in, they were not desirable for some. The people who always lived in these neighborhoods desired them and thought they were just fine. But now we're seeing a shift, right? Now we're recognizing that because of the threats of climate change, because of sea level rise, coastal communities are concerned. And high elevation communities are also concerned, but not for the same reason.
So when it comes to this idea of displacement, Black Miamians, they know it really well. There's another part of that story, different, but this idea of displacement, it goes back to I-95 and Overtown and what happened to a lot of families there.
So in one of the episodes on Liberty City specifically, we spoke to climate activist Valencia Gunder, who also has a home in Liberty City, and her family has always been in Liberty City and have had property in Liberty City. And one of the things she said is that her grandfather would always tell her, they're going to come steal our land because it doesn't flood.
So my grandfather, he always would talk to us and like, they gonna come steal our communities because it don't flood. Like, I remember him saying this as a young child. Like, that was common knowledge in Liberty City for many years. They didn't know the science. They just knew and understood that when flooding happens everywhere else, it don't flood over here. And they knew that that was going to be one of the triggers for them to come take our communities.
So the idea of coming to take our land, you know, it could be something that people were like, oh, well, no, they're not going to come and take your land. But in Black Miami, we have seen this happen before, like the idea of displacement, forced displacement, right? When I-95 was built, the Black community in Overtown was obliterated. They built I-95 right through Overtown. And as a result, folks had to move through eminent domain that you were told that you had to physically get up and move and you had no choice. Now, as it comes to climate change, no one is saying that, you know, by eminent domain, you'll have to move. But the idea of mass displacement is one that is rooted in the psyche of like Black Miamians, like longtime Black Miamians, because land ownership within the Black community has always been something that has been shaky, whether it's I-95 coming through or new development coming through. There's just always this push for the land that you're on.
What are communities, I should say, community leaders doing to tackle this issue? They've heard the story. They know the story. But what are they doing?
Oh, for sure. I know the city of Miami has heard the concerns. The Sea Level Rise Committee has brought this concern to them. In fact, the city of Miami, for its part, is studying, you know, the idea of climate gentrification. This was something that was brought to them by the Sea Level Rise Committee after Jesse Keenan's study came out that looked at, you know, climate gentrification potentially accelerating, you know, displacement in predominantly inland and high elevation communities. So the city did say, like, we're going to look at this and we want to see if this is happening. And if it is happening, how do we, you know, make it so that folks get to stay in their neighborhoods and not be displaced? If you talk to city officials, many of them are very hesitant to say climate gentrification is happening. But what they will say is that regardless of what you call it, they recognize that people are being displaced in a lot of communities that historically have been low income. And they want to figure out how do you solve this problem? Because this isn't just displacement, it's an issue of affordability, the lack of affordable housing, the lack of quality affordable housing, whether you're talking about Little Haiti, Liberty City, Overtown, even parts of Little Havana. So the city is very cautious on how it approaches this, but I definitely know that it is a concern holistically, the idea of affordable housing. And the thing with climate change is it really puts into focus issues that are already there, right? The issue of affordable housing was already here. Whether or not sea level rise was here, we had an issue with affordability. But climate change will definitely put a magnifying glass on some of the issues that are already present. So now when you layer, already we have an affordable housing problem, but the idea that, okay, what's happening in these neighborhoods will accelerate, you know, prices going up, land value going up. Now that just like puts into focus that this problem is actually a bit worse than we thought.
Nadej, what has been your experience reporting on this series, considering that this is home for you? You grew up and this is your story.
I'm one of the rare journalists from Miami that's from Miami. You know, people think that like, oh, there's no one from Miami. Like, there are true Miamians, people who were born and raised here. But, you know, this being home, this being a place that I love, I think it's just important for us to hold up a mirror and look at what's happening and look at it from a humanistic way. You know, we hear a lot of big picture stories about policy, which is very important, but connecting how policy is actually impacting everyday people. You know, when I spent time with Louis Wozman, who was evicted from Little Haiti, and this is a part of displacement that we don't talk enough about, is what is lost, right, when someone leaves the area that they've known for decades. And so now he lives in North Miami Beach, and I've been spending time with him over a year reporting this out. Every single day he gets on a bus, about 45 minute bus ride to go back to Little Haiti, because Little Haiti is home for him, even though it's not where he lay his head at night. And I asked him, you know, like, what happens one day if you can't get on that bus anymore? You know, he's getting older. You know, he's been sick a bit. He just recently had surgery. Like, what happens the day you can't get on that bus? Like, what is lost? Your neighbors who checked for you, who would bring you, you know, a pot of tea made for some Haitian bushes, right? You know, the vendor who you would go to buy your l'huile mascotie, Haitian castor oil, to make your fever medicine when you don't feel well. Or just your friend who you see, you know, playing dominoes under a tree, who you can talk to and, you know, shoot the breeze about Haiti politics. Like, you are now removed from this and you're by yourself in another neighborhood where you don't have this community connection. Like, who is going to check on you to make sure that you're okay? And so when we talk about displacement, we're talking about real people. And the result of that is, you know, for a 61-year-old man, like, you're more alone now, right? And yeah, you can go back to Little Haiti on the bus, but if that's not feasible for you, then you're just alone.
That was WLRN's Nadej Green talking with us about the new three-part series co-produced between WLRN and WNYC. The series, There Goes the Neighborhood Miami, is part of the Stakes podcast. Now, the first part was released today, and the other parts will come out tomorrow and Thursday. And you can find more at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, a conversation with Miami's resilience officer about how the city's responding to things like climate gentrification. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, today again, we're looking at the threats posed by sea level rise on the most vulnerable communities in South Florida. There are rising fears that historically black communities living in higher elevation neighborhoods are being pushed out by developers. They're capitalizing on the higher topography. Now, the special series, There Goes the Neighborhood Miami, was produced in partnership with WLRN and WNYC as their podcast, The Stakes. Again, you can listen to the first episode of the podcast with WLRN reporter Nadej Green by going to WLRN.org. And you'll be able to hear excerpts of the podcast during Morning Edition and All Things Considered all this week. Now, the podcast raises questions of what actions the city, the county, government is doing to protect all of our communities, especially these communities, and, of course, ensure that new housing in these higher elevation neighborhoods will be affordable. Joining me now to discuss that and so much more, Jane Gilbert, Resilience Officer for the City of Miami. Jane Gilbert, great to have you back. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
You got to hear part of that, the interview that I did with Nadej Green. What do you think about these stories of residents in Miami who are being squeezed out because, let's face it, some of these neighborhoods are in higher elevation? That's going to be prime real estate.
Yeah, so I just really adore Nadezhda's reporting because she brings it home very personal to individual people and their experiences. There's no doubt there are development pressures in Little Haiti, Liberty City, some of our highest elevation. And there's also a good amount of evidence to say that some of the reasons for that are because of the elevation of those areas. But I don't want us to lose sight of the fact that Miami is undergoing development pressures, also in low-lying areas like East Little Havana, because of their proximity to the downtown area. We're a growing city. We're actually tied for third in the nation for the fastest growing city in the country. And we have development pressures because we've increased our population by 20% in the last decade, but also because we have this demand for real estate for people who don't live here year-round, who only live here part of the time. That drives up the prices for our residents, our working residents, and our average wage here isn't enough to pay for housing. So I want to put the context of climate gentrification, which is happening, into that whole mix of development pressures happening in the city.
When did you first hear that term? I want to get your sense of what you think about it. Do you think it's a buzzword that's just being used?
So the term was coined by a Harvard professor, Jesse Keenan, and who co-wrote an article that really looked at what the valuation trends were in the greater Miami area, not just in the city, but the greater Miami area. And what he noted was that areas of higher elevation, the property values were increasing faster than those in lower elevations. And he coined the term climate gentrification. He would be the first one to say, we can't say there's a cause and effect. It's a correlation. But I would say, you know, historically you have more gentrification or higher increase in property values where you have lower property values. So the the lower elevations are already priced very high. Yeah. In Miami. So these are growing faster. Now, I will say that climate factors will drive development pressures more and more in the future.
Okay.
So we need to plan, and we need to come up with short-term solutions, which the city is already well on the way, and I'm happy to share those, to address this affordability and displacement crisis.
And some of that came up yesterday. You were speaking at the Florida Chamber Insurance Summit. This was yesterday, and looking at the risks that we face here in our region. One of the key issues that came up was on the $400 million general obligation bond that was passed by Miami voters not that long ago. How are these funds going to be used, you know, by the city, you know, in different resiliency efforts, but, you know, in flood mitigation projects, but also on this issue that we're talking about right now? How do you see that money being used?
Absolutely. I am really proud of the city of not just having the funding all go to flood mitigation, but $100 million to affordable housing. So we're using that for both new construction and the preservation of existing affordable housing, whether it's affordable because they receive federal subsidies and they're required to keep rents low, or it's affordable because it may be not the best housing quality. So how do we use these funds to, when we're preserving, to harden and improve the quality, but then require subsidized rents in those locations? One of the things in our research about gentrification broadly is that the things that cities can't wholesale prevent displacement, right? We can do policies to help mitigate it as best as possible by creating new affordable housing, by preserving that the affordable housing that's there, and then neighborhood stabilization, which is things like the South Florida Community Land Trust that came up recently.
So something that you just said, I want to make sure I get that clear, that, you know, basically displacement, it's just something that happens. I mean, we're trying to build affordable housing because the city is unique and it's growing very fast. But can we not protect neighborhoods? Do we have to accept that places like Little Haiti, you know, eventually, you know, Overtown, that these neighborhoods are going to change We can't necessarily stop it?
What we want is change that still preserves the character and the soul of those neighborhoods, right? We can't prevent any change from happening. Change is the constant, right? So we can't do that. And actually, in the state of Florida, we're preempted from some of the classic gentrification controls, like rent control or mandatory inclusionary zoning. We're not allowed to do that in the state of Florida. So what the city has done is we're piloting in a transit-oriented area of Overtown a affordable and attainable mixed-income housing benefits program,
so we can incentivize the South Florida Housing Link Collaborative. Is that
actually that's a separate program? So we passed this special benefits where a developer can get increased density if they include affordable housing at different levels. And that helps incentivize more development in these higher elevation transit-oriented areas. Also, the Miami Forever Bond, we're providing grant or funds to low, moderate income homeowners who may be at risk of selling their home because they can't do repairs on their home and they can't harden their home. And we've heard a lot about that lately. So they can get funds to shore up their roofs, their windows, and stay in their home as long as possible.
I'm talking with Miami Resilience Officer Jane Gilbert. We're discussing different steps the city is taking to protect folks from sea level rise, increase flood risk, because this is a part of life in South Florida. Also talking about how to protect neighborhoods, protecting vulnerable populations. Again, we discussed the podcast earlier, There Goes the Neighborhood Miami, which is available, part of it on WLRN.org. You can also hear excerpts from that during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Ms. Gilbert, one of the recommendations from the Urban Land Institute study commissioned by the City of Miami was to build high-density housing in the higher elevation areas. But, of course, high-density housing for developers seeking a return on investment means building luxury condos. So how is the city and the county, the state, everybody coming in making sure that, you know, there's going to be an availability of affordable housing, mixed housing in these areas? How do we do that? Is it pressure that you could put on developers, or are you hoping that they're going to do something?
So as I mentioned earlier, we can't do mandatory.
Incentivize them, by the way.
So we have to incentivize them. We can't do mandatory inclusionary zoning, so we can, by adding density bonuses, they can only add that density through adding affordability. By offering investment partnership, by the city saying, here's a portion of our bond money, but you have to use it towards affordable housing. And so those are some of the ideas that we're working on, or actually we've already implemented some of it in the city. And then the city's going to be releasing its full affordable housing master plan in the next
What's the response from developers? Do the incentives work? Does incentivizing work?
So it works, but it's a very careful balance that we need to really understand the markets, and so you have to make sure the deals pencil out, to talk in developer terms. So they still have to work on their end, but that's the art and the science of creating these incentives. And you mentioned earlier the community land trust. Yeah. That's also a neighborhood stabilization strategy. The J.P. Morgan Chase Foundation just announced a $5 million grant to work with the South Florida Community Land Trust in the city of Miami along
the Bright Line
to develop affordable housing. That's a great strategy. In fact, in our climate gentrification workshop that we had with our Climate Resilience Committee and members of the research community, that was the top strategy that everybody sort of put their green sticky dot thumbs up on was the South Florida Community Land Trust idea.
And by the way, we did talk about that on our program yesterday, so you can go back and listen to that interview. There is something unique about this region, that Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach, Monroe work together in a unique compact in dealing with these issues. What I want to know is this, is we have a governor who is, it seems, much more, cooperative on the issue of resilience, has brought in a science officer for the state, has brought in positions that the last governor didn't want, and didn't bring in. I just want to get a sense of, you know, is Tallahassee cooperating now with us down here and what we've been trying to do for years?
Yes. It's a new day in Tallahassee in many ways. They not only hired a chief science officer, but a chief resilience officer who reached out to all the chief resilience officers in the cities and the counties immediately upon being hired to seek our advice and counsel about what we needed from the state, and very open. Jennifer Gerardo, CRO from Broward, was up in Tallahassee meeting with different department leaders about what we want to get in terms of unified sea level rise projections and more research and support tools that municipalities can use across the state.
It's a good way to put it. It's a new day in the state of Florida. Miami Resilience Officer Jane Gilbert, I really appreciate the time. Always do. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, don't forget about the podcast series, There Goes the Neighborhood Miami, available. You can go to WLRN.org for more details. And you'll be hearing excerpts throughout the week on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Still to come, a new film about Cuba just launched at the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival. We'll tell you all about it coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Let's take a trip to Cuba. This song, Mira Como Baila, Look How They Dance, is featured in the new documentary titled Cuba. The film opened the 34th annual Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival this past weekend. It continues to screen this week at the Museum of Discovery and Science, AutoNation IMAX, also in Fort Lauderdale. It's a truly a love song to the island of Cuba. Beautiful shots show us an inside look to Cuba's culture today. Peter Chang is the documentary film director. He is known for his National Geographic films Jerusalem, America Wild, National Parks Adventure, and Planet Power. The Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival runs through November 17th. For more info on this film and the festival, you can go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Peter Chang, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You know, Peter, you're not from Cuba, and you know, you were there recently, really, just a few years ago, but what inspired you to create a whole documentary film about the island of Cuba?
Initially, curiosity, I think. You know, I fairly well traveled, like many Americans, but I didn't know very much about Cuba, other than what I'd seen in glimpses from films like Buena Vista Social Club and Soy Cuba. And so, when I saw these films, they just fascinated me, and I knew I had to go. So just as things were kind of about to open up in December of 2014, decided to make the trip. And once I was there, I couldn't put my camera down.
What was the moment, maybe a person, something that inspired you to make a film about Cuba? Was it something when you got there that said, this is it, I got to tell the story?
You know, there was just something unexpected and special around every corner. So much texture and color and character, community, things that, you know, I'm not used to seeing. Handmade things, vintage things, old buildings with interesting histories. Met a lot of really interesting people and felt I had to document that.
You wanted to tell a lot of different stories, but eventually you brought it down to three stories. There were three separate stories to tell this movie about the Cuban coral reefs, a Cuban ballet dancer, and about conservation. Why did you end up breaking it down to these three stories?
Well, these type of films play in a science museum market, so you know I felt like we had to have a science story of some kind, and the coral reef health and conservation that happened in Cuba seemed like a perfect fit. You know, it's underwater, there's sharks and interesting coral reefs. So that was easy. I think what was more difficult was figuring out which stories to connect to that, which characters. So we came across the ballet dancer and the historian who restores these buildings across Havana to kind of tie it all together. But we did, in the process, look at many other characters throughout Cuba, from taxi drivers to boxers and baseball players. There's so many stories to tell there. And yeah, we only had 40 minutes.
It, as you said, it is a 40-minute film. It's filmed in IMAX, and it is visually stunning. The landscape, the architecture, the dancers, so much beauty. The coral reefs alone, absolutely beautiful. But, you know, when you tell the story of Cuba, it's hard to tell that story and not acknowledge the politics and the fact that many Cubans here in South Florida still hold resentment about the country that was taken from them. When you were there, you saw that, right?
Did I see resentment?
You saw the politics. You saw that side of it, the
sure.
communism and all that. But I just want to get your take on how did you view it? Because, again, your story is about a different side of Cuba.
Yeah, I mean, I think the political aspects are there on both sides, and I mean, you can't ignore it. It's kind of a foundational reason for how things are in many ways. But, you know, I wanted to focus on the humanity and focus on, the commonalities between us instead of the differences. And so, the museum market is geared toward family audiences, and this format lends itself to grand beauty and imagery. And so that was sort of the focus. I wanted to sort of transcend politics and economics if I could with this approach. But, you know, it's there are moments in the film where, you know, we do have to acknowledge it.
You know, let's look at one of the stories in particular that you focus on. This is about this historian and conservationist, Eugenio. Let's take a listen.
They said I was a madman, but it worked. I saved the street and my name became well known. That's when I realized that through decisive action and initiative, I could save Cuba's architectural heritage. People warned me that it was hopeless, but they forgot I was a madman, a good madman. After all, my inspiration has always been another good madman. Our national hero, José Martí.
Who is Eugenio? What is his story?
Eusebio Leal, he's the official historian in old Havana, and he, had a passion for architecture and conservation, and for the last 30 years, he's been tirelessly restoring old Havana, building after building, and he did it in an entrepreneurial way, which is documented in the film.
I'm talking with Peter Chang. He's a filmmaker and the founder of Golden Gate 3D Immersive Media. His latest film is Cuba, which opened the 34th annual Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival this past weekend. For more information and to watch a trailer, you can go to WLRN Sundial on Facebook and Twitter. Peter, what are the projects that he was working on specifically in Cuba? There were a couple of the places that you actually went to, and again, beautifully filmed, some incredible spots that many of us have never seen or been to if we haven't been to Cuba.
Yeah, I mean, he started small with, cathedral, with a street, a wooden street in front of a palace, which he, laid himself on the ground to prevent demolition of. And also the grand theater where the National Ballet of Cuba performs. And so that's sort of the link with our ballet story.
One of the other stories I wanted to get to is the ballet story, the dancer. Her name is Patricia. The film follows her journey as she tries out for the National Ballet in Cuba. Let's take a listen.
I could barely sleep last night. The competition is only a few days away. The pressure is almost unbearable, but I must push myself as hard as I can. I head to the only place where I can relax. I love the beach. The sound of the waves makes me feel free.
Tell me about how big ballet is in Cuba.
Oh, it's huge. I had no idea. And they have the largest ballet school in the world. And they have schools all over Cuba that feed into this main school in Havana. And it's very much, integrated into the normal school curriculum. So they're practicing ballet, 6 hours a day, but they're also there studying normal school subjects.
What did you learn about why ballet, how it became so big? Why is it so big there?
Alicia Alonso was sort of the mother of it all. And she was a famous ballerina and decided to create an institution in Cuba to foster, future generations of talent.
What were some of the challenges of making this film?
Well, I think the politics were responsible for many of the biggest challenges, which involved getting visas and permits, and we had hurricanes, we had popes and presidents and Rolling Stones visiting, and every time, that would give us a huge challenge in terms of not being able to film or having to push back our schedule. So ended up taking 4 years to make this film.
Did you have access to anything you wanted, or again, did you have to ask permission?
We had to ask permission in every case in order to film, but we got pretty much everything we asked for in the end. It took a long time.
Did you have to show the film to them before you could finish it?
No.
Did the Cuban government
have to show them anything? We didn't have to show them any edits of the film, but we did have to show them some of our aerial shots because we were flying over sensitive military airspace in some cases.
Yeah. When you showed it here at the film festival, again, being South Florida with the large Cuban population that you have, what did you hear from people?
I heard it was very positive response, full of love and in some cases sadness from those who had left, before the revolution and seeing it now. I think there were a lot of strong and mixed emotions, but for the most part, very positive. And I think it inspired many of those Cuban Americans to want to visit Cuba. And also bring their Cuban families and friends to come see the film.
Why'd you want to shoot in an IMAX?
Well, it's the most immersive, engaging format that exists, and it really transports the viewer in a way that no other film format can. And I just really love the canvas of IMAX and giant screen and large format. And so I crafted this film, specifically for this format. And it's the way it's meant to be seen, not on a small screen, but on a screen like the Fort Lauderdale Museum IMAX, which is 80 by 60 feet.
And just real quickly, talking to Cubans here in Miami, what do you want them to take away from the film? What's the story you wanted to tell?
Yeah, I want them to be, just immersed and inspired by this place, politics aside, just see the people and the character and the spirit and the passions of and dreams of people in Cuba today. And these are just a handful of stories. There are many more like it, which, you know, we hope to expand on in other projects. Also just to see, you know, what's being done on the conservation side and how that can translate to the rest of the world, because it's a really interesting mystery about how that all happened. It's a great, you know, lesson for the world. I think, you know, there's information exchange here that can help everyone.
Peter Tang, his new film, Is Cuba, opened up at the 34th Annual Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival this past weekend. You can find more information on our social media at Facebook and Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Peter Tang, thanks so much for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's our program for this Tuesday, November 5th. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, we're going to be looking at the story of uninsured children across the U.S., the numbers particularly troubling here in South Florida. Also, this year marks the 30th anniversary of the collapse of the Berlin Wall. We'll tell the story of the two pieces of the wall that are here in Miami. All of that coming up tomorrow on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.